Hi, Rashida.
And
Good, how are you?
I'm doing good. Today's been a great morning so far. It's hot, but it's great.
Really? Yeah.
Like it's gonna be like 99 degrees today, girl.
Oh,
And
God.
it's already. You walk outside and it's like you get kind of like, I wouldn't say punched in the face. It's more like a slow slap across the face and then your entire body of just like humidity.
Yeah, I think this is officially airing in like September, so maybe it's still hot. But if in future people, if you're listening to this, just think back to July. It was like swampy AF everywhere. So yeah, but I think it's a little challenging. It's challenging like dealing with little kids all the time, especially morning routines if you have to go anywhere. But when it's hot, it just adds like a whole other layer of difficulty onto things. People get grumpy, really
Oh yeah,
grumpy.
it's a thing. I mean, we have like the hangry. I think there needs to be a term created for like just hot and over it.
Yeah.
No, maybe we could like come up with that one. And it's not just us women. It's like everybody.
Yeah, it's like this pitta imbalance. And I notice more like angry customer service messages or emails. Not that I get a lot of them, but like if they're going to happen, they're usually during this hottest part of the year. I think people get easily frustrated. I know I do. And until I can cool off, I have to like kind of keep things to myself or else it's not
You'll
very
boil
nice.
over.
Yes.
Well, you're not alone, besties. If this is you, you're not alone. It's a thing. It's a pent imbalance. Have your ice cold water with you. Get in some water, and let's balance that out a little bit.
Cucumbers, watermelons, anything watery and delicious. Let's drink it or eat it.
Yes, all about it. Well, Lauren, what are we doing today? What are we talking about?
I'm really excited because we have a guest on who I actually know personally, who is local to me, IRL. And we haven't had anyone with her expertise on before, so this is going to be a new and really like interesting and different conversation. And I'm really excited because I'm going to get to a ask her some questions that I haven't gotten to in real life. So it's kind of fun for me to get a little bit more personal today. So I'm going to introduce to you all Dr. Auburn E. Ellis. She's an ERYT 500 or an experience register yoga teacher with 500 hours. She's the founder of Studio 5400 and creator of Art in Yoga Flow. Dr. Auburn's recent publications and lectures focus on art as a form of advocacy, restorative justice, and community revitalization. Welcome, Auburn.
Hi, Lauren. How are you? Hi, Rashida.
Welcome. Hi. Well, Dr. Auburn, Lauren has talked you up so much. I am so excited to get to know you, learn more about like what type of yoga you do. But we always ask a question when we have someone on, and we would love to know, what is spirituality to
I think the first thing that comes to mind is what spirituality is not. Spirituality is not religion. And so for me, being a Black girl from the Midwest, growing up Baptist, it was very important for me in my adult life to kind of make that differentiation. You know, this is not necessarily what I've always done. This is a new definition of really being within yourself. And to me, spirituality is connecting with myself, which means I'm connecting with nature around me. So, you know, just that entire universal experience of mindfulness and gratitude.
I love that. I really love that. I feel like everyone we ask, it kind of follows the same line. It's that inner connection, that deep knowing of self, as well as like the, I don't know, playground we get to play in as in the universe. And I think that's something beautiful. I grew up Baptist as well. Very confused a lot. And it wasn't until my like 20s, getting close to late 20s, getting close to 30s, that I just really started like having these big questions. And I think for me, it was a sit back of this guy that I've grown up with that I loved so much, also scared me a lot. Why would we have a God like that? And then it was the big questions like that. And that started my inner journey. Well, why am I thinking this way? What is wrong with me? You know, type of situation. But when you really think about that, you know, our greatest relationship should be to self. We should really know like who we are. And I think you saying that is really what spirituality is about. So thank you for sharing that.
Of course.
Auburn, you have some really amazing expertise and I love your explanation about spirituality. I'd love to know more about your personal journey. How did you start off Baptist, Midwest upbringing to where you are now? So I know I just asked you to tell us like your life story, but I guess I'd like to know like how you got interested in the subjects of your expertise and your transformation from what you were taught to now who you are and what you know.
Of course. I think as children, we follow the model of what our parents give us as a blueprint. And so that's where the Baptist upbringing really comes from. I think my parents were staunch Christians. And when Rashida mentioned like fear, that really resonated with me. I can remember we used to do vacation Bible school and I had this journal like experiencing God and I'm going through these different chapters. And I just always felt like if I go against this, I'm going to be struck down by lightning or, you know, just some irrational fear about what would happen to me within my physical body because of me just like not following what this obscure book is telling me to do. So as I got a lot older, I think that I just started to question everything. And I'm a parent now, and I feel like I want to really mimic that for my child. You know, you should question everything. And so I started to think about origins of the Bible, this King James Version or this New Testament or Old Testament, things of that sort. Like, it wasn't in English to begin with, you know? And so I think that came from travels and studies. In high school, I took 4 years of Latin. And so I'm like, okay, this is one of the original languages. And you see that as you begin to travel. I went to the University of Missouri, Columbia. And for my first summer, I went to Italy. And that was because I was a staunch art lover as well. And so when you start to see like these ancient texts and, you know, kind of the origins of life, of humanity, of human thought processes, that fascinated me. And so not only did it fascinate me, it just helped me question everything that I knew. And so when you just want to experience something different, like I want to read the Quran and see what that's about. I may not believe it, but I just want to see how all of these things kind of connect. And so I just started reading a lot of spiritual texts. So fast forward to like being 30, I guess that was really my 20s, like a lot of travel. I spent a summer in Bangladesh, and started to have like some arguments with people who I grew up with in Kansas City because they were watching my travels. I'll give you an example. When I was in Bangladesh, I started to write about when the Muslims pray there, they don't pray to the east because the Mecca is not east to them. It's on a different side of the globe, you know? And I had sat with these people and prayed with them as I'm in this space. And so when I'm journaling about this, people at home are like, oh my goodness, you know, Muslim people I grew up with, please don't write that. This is not true, you know, and then came back and apologized. My elders came back and said, hey, I did some research for myself and I understand that's incorrect. And it's like, okay, well, this thing that you've studied your whole life, Kansas City, you know, it blows my mind that me as a Christian, in quotes at this time, right? I go to this place, I study this thing, and I'm telling you something completely different. So my 30s was just really full of discovery. I got my doctorate before I was 30. And so I just wanted to like do research and understand the world in a different way. And then started yoga. Yoga was amazing because I was a public school teacher in Chicago and couldn't think about anything else but just like the trials and tribulations of my students, you know, working in underprivileged areas, traveling in the summers, but then really still being connected to my community. And so I went to a hot yoga class. I had a Groupon. Right? I wanted
Oh,
to get
me
like
too. That's so I tried hot yoga.
and a free week. So I was like, okay, if I combine these two things, this is going to be like almost 5 weeks of free yoga. You know, that was the excitement.
Amazing.
And I was going to Punta Cana. So I'm like, okay, summer body. You know, that was the mindset. There was no spirituality, there was no religion. There was just like summer body and travel. So I went to this hot yoga class and it was so hot. All I could think about was how hot it was. Couldn't make it
You
through the
can't breathe.
class. Can't breathe. But that was good enough, right? All the other trials and tribulations of life did not affect me for an hour.
Yes.
So 10 years later, I'm 40 now. That takes you through like 4 decades really quickly. But just this semblance of spirituality over time, you know, heat caused mindfulness for me, right? And so I just think it just kind of evolved over all this time of seeing who I was as a child, questioning who you are as an adult, and then researching and really finding who you are as an older adult.
I really love that so much and your journey. I think the key like word in all this, I mean, you said a lot, which is amazing, but curiosity. As you were telling your story, I was like, wow, this is what we do. We get in our spaces and some of us don't have the ability to travel, right? But that's sometimes
Right.
what libraries are for. But we
Yeah.
don't have the ability to travel and we are in these like closed circuits and we don't know what we don't know. And we don't become curious because we already know what's in our bubble, essentially. So that curiosity that we're meant to lead with and play with and imagine around is staunched by our environment when we're in these spaces. But curiosity is just one of those things I think that will lead you to whatever it is you're looking for. Also, though, I think curiosity is one of the things that when you are in the church, you get in trouble for. And I can go on and on about that. You know, it's a way to like keep us in our place, I guess. But I really love what you said about curiosity. And then also your experience with hot yoga. I'm glad you like reflected on that. I was too afraid to leave the class. I was dying. I was too afraid to leave the class because I didn't want to be the one to disturb anybody. Look at me not wanting to take up space then, right? And I didn't think about that, you know, I didn't think about that. I didn't internalize that experience, but I went back. I actually got a membership and I went back because there was something about that. And I don't know if it was the challenge, because I do remember after I left how good I felt, urged, essentially. But it was something about that. And you just said it like I, for this 1 hour, did not think about my troubles or anything outside of what's going on with my body. And I love that about yoga.
And even if you just lay there, you'll still get the workout because you're going to sweat. It's 106 degrees, you know? So it's a cleanse or it's movement in a cleanse. You can pick.
I wish they would have told me that because I definitely was doing all the things. I would
I
just lay
was like, I physically can't. I'm not going to make it. I'm not even going to try. But I kept going back until I could finish the class. It took me probably a year and a half, you know, just to be able to finish that class. So that was important for me.
I love that. What about your experience with hot yoga, Lauren?
Yeah, I was gonna say it really depends on what kind of hot yoga it is. I think that the first hot yoga I ever tried was a Bikram class, and you're not allowed to just like lay on
Say
the
that word.
ground.
Look,
She's
it's a bad word.
Bessie, she's literally putting her finger to her mouth
No,
saying,
Bessie.
shh, no, we don't say that word.
Oh my God, I left halfway through because up till that point I had
Where you
practiced.
came?
I was chased out and like
Oh my
urged not to
God.
leave, but I was overheating and they wouldn't let us like drink water when we wanted to, and the teacher kept trying to like force me into these forms that, you know, I'd already done enough yoga by then. I knew weren't healthy for my body, even though like my body can do it, doesn't mean that it should. And anyway, I was just, it wasn't my vibe. I left. Since then, I've done some other like hatha classes or like heated vinyasa, which I've appreciated and enjoyed, but I have to be careful, like I was saying with the pitta. constitution earlier. If I'm vata pitta, if I have too much pitta and it's summer, like it's not a nice thing for me. It's hard for me to like be grounded in my emotions. So yeah, it's one of those things I have kind of a, I don't want to say even a love-hate relationship with, just a careful relationship with, I guess.
Sure.
My studio is not heated. It probably never will be. Even like with all the studios going the way of hot yoga, it's just never felt like fully true to what I want to offer, especially when there are so many yogic tools that heat your body without having to like put the external heaters on it or whatever that might be. Like you create the warm internal environment, right?
Yeah, breath work, all of that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Not to say that it can't feel super good, you know, especially on a cold winter day to go take a hot yoga class, because it absolutely can. But I digress. I would love to go into, I'd love to talk about Kemetic yoga. Mm-hmm. So besties, I know Auburn through the Kansas City yoga community, but she's come the last 3 years to my studio to lead a workshop for my trainees that includes Kemetic yoga and also anti-racism in yoga. And she ties the two topics together as well. It's super fascinating. So I will ask, because this might be a brand new word to a lot of you who are listening, what is Kemetic yoga? And how did you discover it?
Sure. So I'll spell it to start with, since we're mostly audio here. K-E-M-E-T-I-C. I noticed when I do my Instagram posts and you try to do a voiceover, they do comedic, like I'm a comedian. And that is not, I'm not telling you jokes during your poses. Did not love that. Kemetic yoga is an ancient Egyptian style of yoga, African-based. Of course, we're seeding Egypt in Africa, right? Not in the Mediterranean. We're not taking it out. And we're really thinking about the hieroglyphs that you've experienced and the posture that you see there, you know, with the perfect spinal structure and the geometric progression of the bodies, and tying that into our yoga practice. When we look at some of these images, they are actually in yoga poses. And so we talk through that in the lecture. We look at hieroglyphs and we mimic the postures in our bodies and talk through and talk through the benefits of that, you know, especially when we are finding that perfect spinal alignment and the way our bodies are really supposed to function is based on the health of our spine. So it's important to understand that relative to the body and then also just the cultural aspect, right? When I did that first hot yoga class, that was at Core Power Yoga in Chicago, and that's the biggest global yoga company. And so there was nothing necessarily associated with African culture with that experience for me. You know, as I said, it was completely tied to something cosmetic that I wanted and also something that my body needed, because I hadn't moved my body since college, you know, and I was 30 at that point. So I think that, well, I'll just talk about that experience and then come back to Kemetic yoga, because when I walked into the Core Power studio, you know, you don't necessarily see a lot of people like me, right? Not taking the classes or teaching the classes, even though you're in a major metropolitan city. And so for me, I think it changes the scope of your wellness, right? Because if you're doing something for wellness, you want to feel like you're in a safe space with people who maybe have your same authentic lived experience. And so after taking a couple of years of Core Power yoga, you know, it was great because it helped me assemble my physical body again, right? In addition to me just wanting to have that beach perfect bod, I was also having some issues like on the right side of my body. It could fall asleep with me sitting, you know, for just like 10 or 15 minutes, like my leg and the whole leg and foot would fall asleep. And, you know, when I would get up, I wouldn't be able to walk. And I'm like, gosh, I've only been sitting here 15 minutes. You know, that can't be normal. So just kind of understanding like the flow of our body and oxygen and how that helps us within the physical body, I just decided that I was going to take that class, the hot class, not only until I could finish the class, but until this tingling and sensation stopped in the right side of the body. And so it was tied to something that I really needed. Kemetic yoga started in Chicago. The founder is Yasir Rahotep, and he has a studio there on the south side of Chicago. And so once I discovered that practice, I was like, oh, there is a yoga practice that really informs my cultural lineage. And so that was important to me. I had been thinking around teacher training, and, you know, when I started, never thought I would be a yoga teacher. It was just like really for me to come back to understanding movement and the benefits for my body. But once I started to think about the underrepresentation in the field, I became really passionate about inserting myself into it, you know, as a practitioner and helping people understand how they can feel more comfortable in those spaces as well. Because African Americans in America are not well. And so we need that. So yes, that was a long answer to what is Kemetic Yoga, but it is a African cultural lineage practice, as well as a really big symbol of geometric progression and understanding how our bodies work.
You know, I've always wanted to ask you, so I've seen, like, you know, obviously everyone assumes, or the story is, that yoga started in what is now India. Mm-hmm. And Egyptian culture is much older, or Kemetic culture is much older than Indian culture. We look at this Vedic period starting somewhere around 5,000 years ago. Or Kemet, when was that founded? Like 20,000 years ago or something like that?
Yes, a lot earlier than that. The first dynasty would have predated Indian yoga. So yes.
Yes.
And I when I do the lectures, I don't necessarily say that out loud. I like mm-hmm. for people to come to it on their own. So I mm-hmm. appreciate that you came to that moment here. Yes.
Well, I mention it in the first lecture that my students receive mm-hmm. in their yoga teacher training, because I want to open up their minds to the assumptions that have been made and to anything that is, you know, ethnocentric. And yeah, I'm wondering, do you have a theory, or do you know theories about yoga migrating from Africa into South Asia?
Well, I think that when the Greeks came into Africa and kind of pillaged Egypt and Nubia and Kush, the movement kind of happened naturally from there, as most things do. So I would assume, I can't say for certain, but I would assume it would be by way of the Greeks and then kind of movement from there. So when we talk about the terms that are strictly Kemetic, like Kemetic is the same as Egypt, right? But the Greeks named that space Egypt before. Mm. They were the Kemites, and Kemet means dark land. And whether that meant the skin of the people or the color of the ground, it was all kind of synonymous. So, and even when I mentioned hieroglyphs earlier today, that's also a Greek name. So the formal name is Metuneter. So everything kind of gets rearranged, you know, when colonialism comes into play, and things migrate naturally.
Thank you for answering that for me. I know, I feel like maybe I was putting you on the spot a little bit, because it's something in my research I haven't been able to find a whole lot on. And, you know, you talk about this in your trainings, like, who is writing history? Who are we, like, whose perspective are we learning about these things from? So mm-hmm. when you talk about hieroglyphs, you're talking about basically learning about it from history books written by the Greeks, written by people who have no skin in the game when it comes to, like, that particular mm-hmm. Culture. So we lose a lot of the cultural relevance.
Sure.
So,
which is why it was never interpreted as yoga.
Exactly. So I love when you go through the different, and I'm sorry, what is the name for hieroglyph again?
Metuneter.
Yes. when you go through the different ones and explain, like, their symbology, it's just so enlightening. And, you know, as somebody who, I just did my ancestry. I have zero African DNA, at least, like, left in my blood. I know we all come from there at some point or another.
Sure.
it's all very relatable. I think it's like, you know, it's universal in a way, like how we connect to the divine, to self, the intelligence of the human mind. Like all of that is written within these symbols, and it's such a beautiful thing. And I just want to thank you for, I guess, your curiosity and taking the time to both discover this, but also share it with others, because it's knowledge that is, I think, universally helpful, similar to the yogic philosophy that we know from South Asia. It's like we take these things that seem so mysterious and ethereal in a way, but actually they're just super applicable to human life in whatever era we're born into. So there's no question here, but just thank you.
No, I agree with you for sure. I thought it was fascinating when we did the last lecture at your studio, you had a med student there. And as I relate to the med students a lot, you know, because I'm talking about physiology, anatomy. Clearly, I have no medical background. I have a PhD. And so I want to make sure that I'm correct. You know, when I'm telling you what the thyroid does and someone went to med school, I'm looking at them and I'm like, hey, if I'm wrong, please correct me. You got to consult with your other experts in the room, you know. And so when she started to talk about how she had never heard of Egyptian practice or anything African within her medical history. And we talked about the studies of the brain, you know, and how they pull the brain out and you can tell that they have completely researched these things. I thought that was fascinating as well. And it's just a global omission of anything African. It's not something that's uniquely American. It's very much a global issue. She was from the Mediterranean, I believe she said, right?
Yes. Yes, she is.
Even yeah, closer to the region.
It's quite interesting. I think that from the Western point of view, like the Greeks and Romans are this pinnacle of opening the gate to modern science. And it's totally, totally wrong, right? Like if you look at this Kemetic culture, if you look at the Vedic culture, like they had so much knowledge about the brain, which is something that you share about, but in you know, in the Vedas and their sciences, like they know about astronomy, they know math, like they know these things in such a deep and intricate way that I think, like, I don't know, it's just so, it's sad and wrong and so uncurious to make these assumptions about thousands of years of human life that they were, some would say, like primitive or barbaric, when that's just not the case.
I think that's just part of the whole global colonialism, right?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
a symptom of global colonialism, for sure.
Where was I going with this? You have any questions that have
we
come
all
up?
Had to like pause because it got so deep. It's like,
Well, no, it really is good. When you, I think the issue is sometimes like, and I'm going to say this just as like a Black woman, I don't sit and think about things like that because it is very uncomfortable. When you think about, you know, where we come from being erased like that, not, I know when I went to school, I live in a predominantly white area. This is where I grew up. And it was very uncomfortable being a Black child learning about Africa or slavery or anything like that. And it wasn't until I got out of school that there were instances of me knowing that people who look like me were inventors, engineers, builders, doctors. And you know, even on that level, it is still being omitted. I mean, we have things like Black history, great, but like, when are we really going to change the narrative and really teach our children? Like, and especially for me and my children are biracial, but they still have some African descent, and they should know, like, people like their mother did these things. I swear to goodness, I did not know until I got older. I was telling my grandmother the other day, you know, I went to Hampton University for a year, $20,000 down the drain, but I went for a year, but it changed my freaking life.
Yeah.
To see so many of us together.
Black scholars. Yes.
Being about something. And that, and when you think about even in my small little town, it's so sad. And I think it was done a purpose. It was done a purpose, but we have the ability now to like have these conversations and talk, and you, Auburn, having the curiosity to like really get the facts and bringing those in to these closed spaces, right? I know for me, this is why I want to have women come here and host gatherings, is because let's open up the world a little bit for people who maybe who can't get out there and have these conversations. But it is something, and it is sad. And, you know, it's up to us, I think, to really like talk about it and teach about it and share with our children about it.
Sure. And I love that you say that you hardly ever think about these kinds of things, because I think part of my problem is I'm inundated with them all the time. Uh-huh. All the time. I can't go anywhere. I can't do anything. Every part of my day, I'm just thinking about just the effects of our political system. That especially right now, you know, that's a big
one.
Yes. Because it affects everything we do, you know, where we go to school, the jobs we have, the money we make, how our families prosper. All of those things are important. And when you mentioned that, you know, you went to an all-white school and how that affected you, that had a psychological effect on who you are, you know, because you had no idea that people like you could do anything productive, you know, or be contributors to society.
Yeah, not, and not outside my family.
Way.
Yeah, and not outside my family. I mean, I know when I went to school, there were some, but mostly I got bullied and picked on for being too white, you know? And I know you're absolutely correct. Like, I don't think about that stuff unless I have to come like face to face with it. For me, like when I know that someone is treating me a certain way because of the color of my skin, it's sometimes a hard pill to swallow, because I don't want to say I don't see color, because I do, but I don't have this like deep need to like fix something. If that makes sense. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense.
Yeah. And see, that's the thing. And
I'm not sure if it's a good thing though.
But I think, I don't know. I can't say it is or not, but you're a fixer. And so having someone like you to come to talk about these things and to share, like if you weren't a fixer, if you weren't curious in that way, like we would both be like, well, I don't know. Well, I don't know. You know, I think it's needed. I really think it's needed, because again, I'm in my bubble here, and I do get out. I go to retreats and I travel. And that's another thing about traveling, bringing it back to what you talked about. Like, you get to experience so many other things and just see how big the world actually is. And the things that you've been fed, you know, might not have necessarily been a lie from the person you heard it from, but because of their belief system, it's made as fact, and it's not fact. Just you guys talking about the Vedas and Kemet, it is not fact. Like, what our history has taught us is not fact. It's whoever the conquerors were wanting us to know exactly what they wanted us to know. And so I think going into that, and that was another reason why the Bible started confusing me. Like, even learning that there are so many things that were left out of the Bible, the translations, the written part didn't even come until years and years down the road. Like, we've had that game of telephone, right? We all know that things get lost in translation. So knowing now, that bothered me enough, and I got curious enough around that to kind of, you know, changed my belief system in that way. But I think it's people like you that need to get, that are curious in that way and that want to fix and see the change. I just don't know how. I don't know how, other than teaching my children, talking about it in the spaces, and, you know, creating and meeting people like me when I'm out in these predominantly white spaces.
I think when you talk about the religious aspect, and you felt the need to change your belief systems because of the way that it affected you and your everyday life, right? So for me, when I decided to, well, I went to all Black schools as a child. I mentioned earlier today, my daycare that I went to in the 80s is right around the corner from here.
Amazing.
Located in the Vine Street District here in Kansas City, Missouri. And Vine Street was where the Black people could go. It was the only place, you know? It was unlawful for us to cross over Truce and Paseo in these areas. And so this is where I went to high school, you know, and where my father's business was rooted as a child. And so when I went to college and I went to Mizzou, it was a culture shock for me. And I was really in a deep depression all through college, because I was like, you know, I've grown up my whole life learning about how great we are as a people. Now I'm in this place where everyone's telling me excuse my language.
We're not so
really
great.
Not shit.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh my gosh. What like a difference in like our mm-hmm. college experiences. And mm-hmm. and it's the extreme, right? Like yeah. where is the middle ground? I think when we get older and we like live a little life, we can come to that middle ground. But mm-hmm. wow, I couldn't imagine. I mean being I was elated coming out of college and coming out of that experience. I was like, yes, like mm-hmm. yes, we are. Like we are the shit. I mean, and then you having that experience of damn.
Yeah.
I really do
live in Missouri. Like, it was like, oh, shit, I do live in Missouri. This is terrible. This is where it really sets in for me. Columbia, Missouri.
You know, man.
where the Waltons are from. And even fast forwarding to, you know, how Lauren found my workshop. Like, I had to create this email list on my own of, you know, studios in Kansas City. I mean, there are no Black-owned studios in Kansas City. There weren't at this time. And so it was like, all right, let's send an email to everybody and say, hey, you know, there was the death of George Floyd and your studios may not necessarily be supporting underrepresented groups and you're doing teacher training. So how can we work together as a community? I've created this workshop, you know, and that was really hard for me because it's like, everybody in this yoga community is going to hate me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, what has she been talking about, you know? So I think it took a lot of courage on my part just to create the workshop. And then on Lauren's part to be able to say, hey, actually, this is a need. You know, I'm already meeting the need in one way because I know she was working with another group. But she's like, hey, how do we evolve this, you know, and push us forward together? So I think the allyship is such a pivotal component of where we are in the world now.
I have a question for you. And I know you're mostly like yoga centric, but I meet in my retreats that I go to, it's usually like a handful of us, the retreats that I'm a part of, maybe like 5 to 10 women out of like 200 that mm-hmm. are Black or women of color, I should say. And they're so excited to see other women of color in these spaces. So for that being like just this pivotal thing, you know I'm trying to do my part to bring more of us together. What would you suggest for those women who are seeking, you know, that type of like sisterhood in a space mm-hmm. that we don't really see it?
Sure. So I will back up and say I'm not mostly yoga centric. I think Lauren knows me mostly as yoga centric.
Okay,
but my practice
yeah.
is very much a lot of different disciplines are included.
Okay.
I think that affinity groups are very important, and I've founded some and have some workshops that support groups of that sort. I think that the fact that you all are we actually meeting, or are you guys just kind of meeting eyes in the room and you're like, oh, I see you. Are you looking for a way to connect more?
You'll see like the progression of the week go by where we're like, until like we're all sitting together at like our yes. meal times and stuff. And this past time, I know the time before I would like individually get, but we're actually starting a group. I was telling Lauren, we're starting a group and we're actually doing circles together virtually mm-hmm. since we're all living differently. But, you know, it's like 5 or 6 of us, right?
Sure.
I know that there's so many more women who feel this way and feel this need to like have a safe spirituality space and also see and be taught by women who look like them.
Yeah, I think it's a need in every field, right?
Mm-hmm.
I just did a workshop with some women from Edward Jones, and they just wanted to do breath work. You know, they were an affinity group. It was probably like 75 Black women who worked for Edward Jones all over the country. And financial work is hard, right? They just want to get together and understand how to breathe better when I'm in the middle of an email or in the middle of a meeting. You know, how can I respond more mindfully and take a moment for myself? And so as we kind of convene in these large groups, it's very important to find affinity groups and find a common theme within you all. Like, what do we want to work on? You know? Is it the professional development or is it just breath work or mindfulness and just kind of picking a goal and moving toward it together?
I love that so much. Lauren, I'm going to bring us back to February because You know what I'm talking about? Okay. So Lauren and I went to Costa Rica together. We went to a gathering called Origins Gathering. We talked about it on the pod. And our experience was different. We had our kiddos with us, but Lauren and I would usually sit together or sit with others. And there was one of the instructors, I guess, was with Origins. I'm not really sure the layout of how that worked, but they were having a BIPOC table where everyone would get together and sit and meet, you know, and she was pretty much saying, this is for those women who probably feel a little outside of themselves, not being around people, or so they get to meet people that look like them. And there was an older Black woman, I'm assuming that's her nationality, so that's what she looked like to me, that started arguing at how this was not what we were supposed to do in these spaces, and that almost like, I don't understand, you're excluding other women, and this is not what this grouping is about. And she completely ruined the mealtime. I was sitting at the table starting to meet people, and I was so uncomfortable that I left. And so I would love to get your thoughts on women who feel that way about just us gathering together. Sure. I was just baffled. And of course, she was a little bit older, so I don't know if it was a generational thing.
I was just going to say that. It's a generational thing.
Oh, man.
You got to think about it from her perspective. You were lunch countering her, right? Now, I want to back up and ask, what was the race of the person who was setting up this BIPOC group? The person who was telling you to go and sit at this table?
She wasn't
telling.
Were
they a person of color?
She was Black. She was Black. Yeah, okay. She was suggesting. It was like, there was an announcement at mealtime, and then she's like, you know, if you want to meet with us and everything, if you want to, yeah, it wasn't a, this is what you need to do. It was completely open for you to do what you did and didn't want to do. It wasn't like a, like, Lauren, am I missing anything from, you know, my experience?
No, I don't think so. Just from seeing it on my end, it looked perfectly understandable. I don't know.
Sure.
It wasn't like forcing. It wasn't like forced segregating or anything like that.
There.
We were having a different experience than people who weren't there with their kids or people who were pregnant. So for me, like, it just made sense to connect in that way. But yeah, it was interesting to kind of see it all go down. And I know Rashida was like, you know, she didn't want to sit at that table during this discussion, not because it wasn't interesting, but just because it was uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she just wanted to eat.
Yeah. Not right now.
Even in the jungle
would have been better.
Enjoy my meal.
I think with workshop planning, you kind of have to think about time and place. So as you said, Rashida, it made you uncomfortable because that was your time to chill, right? This may have been better suited for like an evening optional session. Oh, you know, we want to meet as a BIPOC group, and if you have interest in that, then you should join us. Not a call out in front of a whole group of people, you know? Send an additional email or a little note or something in the program. And just relative to the woman who overreacted, I think we just have to think about ageism, right? The same way I would have found it highly inappropriate if the woman giving the directions would have been like a white woman, you know, it's like, that doesn't necessarily feel good. The same way we have to think about race, we have to think about age, right? It's, or even being a mom, like Lauren said, all the moms are here. We're having a different experience. We want to sit at the table and talk about how I was able to take a poop this morning and my kid wasn't busting through the door. That was awesome, right? A group of single women don't want to hear that. So it's the same. Age, race, experience, we have to consider them all in group spaces. So I think that sometimes BIPOC, the words we use can be triggering to people, right? Like, BIPOC is a new thing. You know, we weren't saying BIPOC 10 years ago. I don't think
we
were saying
it. Grandmother, and she's like, what is that?
What even is that? Exactly. Exactly. So you use a bit like a big acronym, right? And then you're like, and then if you're of color, come sit over here. Like, what? You know, you got to kind of think through that. So think about if that had been your grandmother, right? She doesn't understand the acronym. And then you're just saying, hey, because you're of color, come talk to these other people of color. So I'm not necessarily saying she didn't overreact, but, you know, there was some reasoning behind it that we kind of just have to be cognizant of.
Yeah, and that's that compassion piece. I think Lauren and I always come back to as well, for sure. Yeah, and I think that makes sense. And yeah. Also, like, just water, like, just learning how to, like, walk the waters, or, you know, navigate the waters, because this something so easy, I feel like, just feels so hard sometimes in certain spaces. And I think you're right. It's not just about the color of our skin. It's about the times that we grew up in and what, you know, things have changed, I guess, from when my grandmother was even my age or younger, in her 20s, to like me now being almost 40. Things have changed a lot. And so a lot of that, we bring up triggers. We bring up all of these different things. Like, you know, I grew up in this predominantly white area, but, you know, she might not have, and it might be something completely different for her. So yeah, thank you for highlighting that and bringing that out. I think that's something to keep aware of when we are creating these spaces.
Can I add something just for a little more information about the gathering? So this was meant to connect women with different, not just indigenous, but different practices that connect us with our origins. So there was like doll making, and there's fabric dyeing, and
ancestral soap making.
Yeah, there's African drum making. There's like different dances, like belly dancing isn't the right word, but there's like Middle Eastern dancing, and so that was very cool, and it's something that needs to be done as consciously as possible by the different participants, especially white participants. And I could see definitely some appropriation happening and people just not being super conscious of what they're doing. And I could see how that would make any BIPOC attendees feel some type of way, or feel kind of uncomfortable and feel this need to caucus. So that was kind of an interesting thing too, but I think that was something that Elder maybe was cognizant of and nervous about, causing some like derision or division. Sure. Like, we're going to get together and start, like, I don't know, pointing out that they're white women with box braids who got them from Costa Rican braider who was there, right? Like, it could have gotten real messy.
I'm so
trying to hold it in.
You know what I mean? Including the person who is the founder of this, gathering.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it.
So
there.
it was already a really tough week physically.
Sure.
Maybe she was kind of like, yeah, maybe we can save this for another.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I don't know.
The box braids probably would have put me over the edge as well. I don't know.
But you could tell, like, the women getting them had no, they're ignorant. You know what I mean?
Sure.
I got braids. I got French braids.
Yeah. Yeah. Her and Gemma got cute little French braids.
Yes. they were helpful for the week, but.
Oh, yeah. And the heat, for sure.
It just speaks to the need to consult with people like you, people with some sort of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
I think before even creating a gathering like this.
Totally.
You know, and like,
and I would
these
say,
were,
what about, yeah. I was just going to say, what about the indigenous people in the region? Like, have we talked to the
they
Costa
were,
Ricans?
They
were
there.
Were they
yes.
present?
They were there.
I love
yes.
that. Okay.
They were
okay.
there. They're speaking Spanish too.
Okay. That's cool.
So, yeah, so there were considerations made, but it could go deeper, which became
sure.
evident.
Sure.
Hi, Gemma. Yeah, I think it's, you know, again, like, it's not until you experience things that you see the need for having these conversations. And,
yeah.
you know, when we say women gathering, we're just like, oh, we're coming together and we're talking, but there really needs to be these considerations. And I never really thought about it that way as well. Mm-hmm. So seeking out just more people like you, Dr. Auburn, honestly, So grateful to have you here speaking to this and being open and honest. I think sometimes we don't want to put ourselves out there, but I think it's important. I really do.
Yeah. It's hard, though. It's very difficult to find the courage to speak up, you know? I think when Lauren and I saw the need, I mentioned earlier, it was after the death of George Floyd, and we have these yoga groups, and people were just going crazy. I mean, the things that were being said were terrible, and I would never chime in. I feel like I just sat for 2 weeks and just scrolled through and just read people's comments and responses and took mental notes about, you know, these yoga studios here locally and what they were presenting themselves as in this moment, in this very, very important moment. It was absolutely a time to choose sides, right? To choose allyship, to choose courage and justice and equity, and understand that there had to be a response. So after sitting and just kind of reading for a couple of weeks, I was like, okay, you've got to create some sort of programming. You know, my doctorate is in adult and continuing education, and it started out just teaching teachers how to teach, right? But it's so much bigger than that. Adult education is helping humans. We're adults. How do we function in this ever-changing world? And it's important, especially if you think about just technology in general, like how fast technology moves. You know, people have to know what a widget is now, what an emoji is, what's an app, right? Software, hardware, all of these things. 15 years ago, none of those words mattered, right?
Nope.
And none of those things mattered. So if we can learn for the sake of technology, we can learn for the sake of humans. And so I think I talked about how I kind of put that letter together and challenged local yoga studios to bring me in, you know, and let's talk about how we can make changes so that we're supporting underrepresented groups in the Kansas City area, because wellness is something that everyone needs. And I made the same appeal to Core Power Yoga. And, you know, I was an employee for them at the time, and we had been totally shut down, as most businesses were. And so when they kind of told us, hey, you're going to be rehired, and here's the terms of that, here's all of our COVID terms, I wrote them a very long letter, and I talked about 3 racially charged incidents that I had had in studio, you know, from my peers, right, to just kind of prove that DEI work is necessary. And my appeal to them was, if you can roll out all of these COVID protocols, you know, what we do to spray, wearing masks, all of these things, you can roll out cultural protocols with the same responsiveness. We can do it together. And so they've since hired me as a consultant, and I've designed about 9 hours of DEI lecture for internally for their teachers, for their 300-hour programming. You know, I'm just applauding any and everyone who has responded to the call to action, regardless of what field you're in. You know, it doesn't matter if it's yoga, technology, hospitality. We all just need it. We got to brush up as adults on the education.
Yeah, thank you so much. Oh, go ahead, Rashida.
No, go ahead.
Oh, Rashida and I have had a lot of conversations lately about spirituality in general and what it means to embody it and to live it. And I just want to give you props because I feel like you are grounding these beautiful, like, ethical concepts that we learn into reality. And it's hard work, and you've had to face probably a lot of opposition, you know, while being immersed in these things that, like Rashida said, are unpleasant. Like, I don't want to think about them, right? Mm-hmm. For you to live your life in this way, it's very inspiring. And just thank you.
I appreciate it.
I know Rashida had to step away for a moment. If we have a little more time, I wanted to dive a little bit into one more topic. Would that be okay?
I got more time for you all. Come on, besties. Let's do it.
I know you said your doctorate is in continuing education. You also are a student of or an expert in art in the African diaspora, correct? Yeah, because you just do all the things. I was thinking about what Rashida said earlier about how history is written by the conquerors, right? And yet, art isn't. Like, yes, art can be commissioned by rulers, by those with a lot of wealth. But there's something, there are truths within art that aren't within, written within the histories, right? I'd love to know, like, how your curiosity led you to that subject, mm-hmm. and maybe some of the things that you've learned through that.
I love that question. So this room that I'm sitting in right now, I mentioned that I'm in Kansas City, Missouri, in the Vine Street District. This is an old firehouse, and it's probably a 100-year-old firehouse. And so this was the Black firehouse. When I was a child, this was the Black archives of Kansas City. And so one of my first field trips, probably in elementary school, I came to this very room, and there was a slave cabin right where I'm sitting, and like a setup of all of these African artifacts from the transatlantic slave trade. And I can remember that was my first memory of, you know, being in a museum or being in this archival space and understanding what it looks like to preserve something so that people in the future can look and say, wow, this is what really happened. I can remember not only was the cabin there, but there were like these chains where you could see how, you know, it went around the ankle of my ancestors, the ankles and the hands. And it was devastating for me to see as a child, but it was also just like, okay, this is my lineage, you know, this is a part of me and I need to understand it. So when I was at Mizzou, I've talked a lot about being depressed there. And I think I was making a lot of art. And I will say I made this one piece. It was a lithograph of this guy being lynched, this Black man being lynched from a tree. One of the ways that they would lynch you is not around the neck, but to hang a hook in your ribs and hang you from your ribs. And so I recreated this image. And the lithograph was beautiful, very detailed, but the students were just like, and the teacher was just like, why are you making artwork like this? You know, it's not appealing. It's not relevant. And to me, it was very relevant, you know, because it was my experience and no one else in this room had this experience or understood what it was like to be in Middle Missouri and feel like this could happen to me at any moment, you know? And so I think I stopped making art for a long time after that. And in Chicago, I did my master's in museum education just to kind of understand how spaces work. I worked at the Nelson Atkins Museum here for a while and then traveled to just look at all the artwork that I had seen. So I will go back to a challenge to you, Lauren, and say, you talked about how you don't think that art is necessarily affected by all of these things that I talked about. I want to ask both of you a collective question. You want to clarify? Do you want to say
something? Oh, yeah. No, I think she said that.
Oh, okay. What were you?
Did it?
What was the original?
Sorry, I just meant that the truth is that art is better able to convey truth many times because of the artist's experience than the written histories that were written by the conquerors.
Yes, I agree for sure.
So
yes,
I'm absolutely not saying it's not affected by environment or history.
Gotcha.
I just mean it's infused with those things in a way that a lot of times what we learn in school is not.
For sure, yeah. Because books are written, right? And art is, you're right, from the heart and really can tell a story. Yes. I think that sometimes
and, like,
there's
you
just
have
a...
to be... Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, sorry. You have to be really observant and take the time with the art to get these truths from it. Mm-hmm. And not everyone does that. Not everyone sits with a piece. Not everyone appreciates a piece. Not everyone is going to take the time to understand it, like you're talking about your fellow students.
Yeah. It can get really emotional too.
It can. Yeah. So I guess I was wondering about your experience, you know, learning through these artifacts and artwork, if that, like, and I know, I'm sure it did, but awakened like truths within you and about your origins too.
It definitely awakened truths in me, yes. Especially from that first experience that I talked about in this room. Like, I can remember what it felt like when I walked in the building, what it smelled like. You know, me looking up the stairs and being like, wow, I wonder what other artifacts they have up there. You know, it revealed a piece of myself. Yeah, it was very emotional. And I think it also just depends on like your access and opportunity for those things. You know what I mean? That wouldn't necessarily have been an exhibition that you would see at the Nelson or, you know, something of that sort. So just being able to find access to even those artists that we think are really prevalent and that can learn some truth from them.
Thank you for sharing that experience. It's really powerful. I hope it inspires our listeners to, if they have the time and access, to go visit their local art museum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For sure.
And really just like sit with it for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sit with those stories.
Yeah. Rashida, anything else you want to ask or add before we start to wrap up?
I don't think so. I feel like we've like chatted about so many things, which is really great. I really love this conversation, Dr. Auburn, and I feel like we could probably have you back to talk a little bit more in the future. But no, this has been very enlightening and just like inspiring in a way. I sometimes feel like when Lauren and I would talk about archetypes, you know, I'm like, oh, Lauren, I'm not really the warrior. I'm not really the activist. That's just not who I am. And I feel okay with that. Sometimes, but sometimes I don't. And like hearing your story, hearing how you've like gone out to like really create the continuing education for humanism to, you know, for us to really learn from these things and incorporate these things into our businesses, it starts to make me think, what is my part in this? I have these conversations. I see the need. I never think that I would be the one to want to like send out the letter to all the yoga studios, right? You know, that's really brave and takes a lot of gut and grit. But what can I do here in my space to be that person, keep having the conversation, to keep talking? So thank you for being an inspiration around that. It really means a lot.
Thank you all for having me. We did not talk about gentle parenting, though. That's where I need the continuing education.
Oh, yes. So, besties, just like what Lauren and I do, when we have our guests come on, we just chat for a little bit. Lauren goes over the flow, and we were talking about kiddos. And we were saying, Dr. Auburn has a 2.5-year-old. I have my almost 2. Lauren has her 3. And then y'all know I have Macy 5. And I was just talking about, like, the side eye I've been getting and like the wording that likes to come out of their little cute mouths. And, you know, if I was not on this path, things would probably be a little bit different. So we were talking about gentle parenting. It is a spiritual path. And you know, Lauren and I, all of us are mamas here, so we could take a moment. I told Dr. Auburn, I was like, oh, you know, Macy would say something to me and I'd be like, oh, that's an interesting word. Tell me more. What do you mean by that? And Dr. Auburn was sharing how her daughter said whatever to her the other day. And what was your response, Dr.
Do not ever say that again. And that probably was not gentle. It wasn't. I'm sorry. I'm putting myself out there.
And
but
no,
you
and
don't
you
even
have
know
to
what
because
that
I
means.
Think exactly. She's 2.5, right? She's yes. Probably mimicking. But I think this is how spirituality is as well in how we consciously parent our children. Like you said, you had that reaction, right? And then now you're like, you know what? There's probably like a better way to do this.
Yep.
So
and you
Lauren,
gave it to me,
and it's learned. There have been so yes, but there are so many times where I would sit back and say, that probably was not the best way to handle that. Mm-mm. And I will check in with them. And you know, something that's been so humbling as a parent that my parents never did. I've apologized to my daughter multiple times when I've maybe come out in anger or frustration. And 9 times out of 10, when I find myself in those spaces, it's because, and this is me putting myself out there, it's because I'm distracted and I'm not in the present moment with her that I'm trying to do something else. And it's just like an autopilot type of thing that happens. And so I do apologize. No, it doesn't. I don't apologize all the time. And has she held it over my head a couple times? Maybe. She's like, "Mommy, remember when you told me sorry for X?" Oh. You know, what parent would want their child to say that to them? But it's such a learning experience. And, you know, for me, I feel like we're in this together. I feel like when we start thinking that, like, it's our job to protect them and keep them safe. But mm-hmm. I think it is also our job to learn and see what it means to, like, be a child again and learn how to parent from that place of curiosity, imagination, and play. Because we don't do that as adults enough. And so that, to me, is really what conscious or gentle parenting is. It's like recognizing the things that we had when we were kids and saying, "I don't want that." Recognizing when we do that thing and then changing the narrative to something a little bit different. So I know there's probably like courses and different things and all that people are going to say, "Oh, this works and that works." But I was joked, like some of my friends would joke, like, "Oh, you're doing that gentle parenting thing. You're going to let your kids walk over you." And that's not what gentle parenting is, in my mm-hmm. opinion.
I'm learning that. I don't know if I'm there yet, but I'm learning that. And I appreciate the learning opportunity from you all.
Yeah. Lauren, do you have a best practice?
Well, I think the repair is so important, like you talked about, you know, because I think trying to be perfect with this is just not helpful in any way. And it only leads to disappointment and guilt and, you know, all these internalized feelings that we carry around with us as moms. So being able to just like, gosh, we talked about this in the anti-racism training too, Dr. Auburn, but being not afraid to be wrong and apologize mm-hmm, is like such mm-hmm. an important part of this practice too, I think, with our kiddos, showing some humility. But okay, I'll take your dinosaur outfit off. Come here. Yeah, you gotta take
perfect
it off
timing.
To go potty. Sorry. Yes. She has to go potty, but she's wearing like a full dinosaur suit right now, which is very difficult. But yeah, I think just like being conscious, being present, that's the best we can do, really. And having community, like just talking to each other. So many moms I've had these kinds of conversations with will say like, "Man, I wish people talked about this more." And I feel lucky because I'm like, I'm around people who talk about this stuff all the time.
Yeah.
but, you know, a lot of people feel really isolated in what they're doing and they have this like this guilt that they carry around with them where we're all, I think as long as we're trying our best and making changes when they need to be changed, that's the sure. best we can do. I was going to tell you, Auburn, too. My daughter, she's 3.5. She said whatever maybe like 2 days ago, and I'd never heard her say that before.
First time.
She didn't even say it right. And like, and I'm sure she had no idea what she was talking about. So I just ignored it. But I was like,
typically really good at ignoring it because, you know, you're not supposed to acknowledge the behavior because then they're going to do it again. But she said it in the right context. You know, it was great diction. And I'm like, you know what? We're not saying that to mom anymore. And I know she's going to say it again because I handled it wrong. And I'm reflecting that. I handled it wrong. Lauren,
no,
you
set a boundary. And that is I think it gets misconstrued with gentle parenting that you're permissive, but like that's not true. Mm. You have to set those boundaries. You have to teach them how to treat you. You have to teach them how to treat other people.
Mm-hmm. I know. There have to be boundaries.
Whatever
yeah.
in that way is probably not the way, right? So.
And I love what Rashida said earlier. She said, "You know what? That wasn't a very kind thing to say. Let's try it again."
Yes. Yeah. And she does. And sometimes I could just, you know, when we used to get the look as kids, like it wasn't a good thing to get the look. Mm-mm, I can do the look now and she'll look at me and she'll be like, "I think I'll try that again." It's just a learned behavior and it's not, and the look isn't like, "I'm going to, you know, something's happening later," or whatever the case may be. It's a more of a,
it's a redirect.
Okay. Yeah. Let me pause because mommy's giving me that look like something is not right. And let me think about what I did. And it was nice hearing the very first time I was like, "Oh, I'm doing something right. This is amazing." Mm-hmm. She said it again. And I kind of feel like this all ties back into our spirituality. And Lauren and I had another guest on the pod, and we talked about, you know, how momming and spirituality, you don't really see that in our space as well. But this is the spiritual path. This is what we're doing, how we're raising our kids, being aware, being present, being conscious, making the decision to choose love and compassion in these moments of whateverness and ish attitude and sass. I mean, it really is, because I can see sometimes I can see why my parents were the way they were, because it is hard and we are not acknowledged. Not that we have children to be acknowledged, but when you see other people acknowledged for like meditating for 2 hours or doing these things and going off on retreat and having a silence, whatever, and not being acknowledged like as it's just what you're supposed to, you're just supposed to do this, you know?
Sure.
It's hard. It's hard. And it's, I don't know, there's something about parenting and really choosing a different way that should be acknowledged. And I know I was made fun of a lot, but it is the spiritual path. It is another way to come back to yourself, because there's a lot of, I mean, it really is. You got to do the work.
Oh, I know.
It's forcing you. It's like almost not that slow slap. It's like a slap in the face sometimes. This is not how you wanted to act. This right here, this, what you did will dim her light if you keep doing that. It's time for you to figure out what's going on and change that so that she could be a better parent for her. And it takes a lot of like not listening to other people too, which is sometimes not what we're taught. We're taught to take this course and do this thing, and this is how it worked for me. But this parenting thing doesn't all work for, you know, it's, the child is different, and the lessons that they're here to give us are all different. And we're supposed to learn these lessons. So,
we have to learn them. That's the thing. When I do my workshops, I always tell people, you know, lifelong learning is important. My workshops are important because I learn as much from you as you learn from me. And that's how I feel about my kid. And that's how we're going to keep this relationship moving. I learn so much joy from her. You know, we've talked about being inundated with all of these things all the time. My baby has reminded me, you need to bring joy back to your life. And so every day I try to lean into that for her. And it's important.
Simplicity. Yeah. Like that's the thing about children, that you don't need all the fluff. You don't need all the extra things. Mm-mm. You know, Lauren and I were like, we haven't done this in a while or that in a while, but like spirituality too can be just as simple as looking at your child and bringing more joy in your life. I love that so much.
Thank you. We have
one more. Actually, before we ask this question, where can our listeners find you, Dr. Auburn?
Oh, cool. I am on Instagram, Dr. Dr. Auburn, AUBURN. And I'm on Facebook as well as Auburn Aesthetic. Let's see. I've got two websites, drauburn.com and artandyogaflow.com. So take your pick.
Amazing. We will have that in the show notes too. And Lauren, do you want to do the honors?
Yeah. Last question. Will you be our bestie?
Oh my gosh. Yes. I could never ask. I've been saying it the whole time.
just dropping, you know, bestie. Subconsciously, little hints here and there. Amazing. Well, I love this conversation. Really, truly, honestly, deeply inspiring for me. And Lauren, I really appreciate you doing the work, bringing up these conversations, feeling the need to really, you know, highlight these things, because that is also brave as well.
Aww, so thank you, friend.
I want to thank the two of you for having a really open and vulnerable conversation about your own experiences and letting me be a fly on the wall during certain parts of it, because it's a big learning experience for me. I already respect both of you a lot, and you know, this is how we grow. This is how we learn, is this deep listening and this deep openness, right? So thank you.
And I appreciate both of you for letting me in on your parenting tips. I am really trying hard at gentle parenting. I promise you I'm trying hard. I need this.
Of course. We are here, bestie, anytime. Lauren, yes. I love you. Dr. Auburn, thank you for being here. And besties, yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. We will talk soon.
All right.
Thank you.